NHL, frankly, has missed their own deadlines relative to when they thought that it was going to be ready.
The Interior Department says Shell can proceed this fall, but time may be running out. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Yupik skin sewing and cultural icon has died.
Those people in the past used to say that this is why that decoration of a tassel was put on, this pretend arrow that was shot into a man.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at FNBAlaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The U.S. Department of Interior has granted Shell Oil the go-ahead to begin operations in the Chukchi Sea. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, while both parties are deeming the move a success, it does not allow Shell to drill for oil just yet, and the calendar is working against them.
Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar assured skeptical reporters on a conference call that the announcement had nothing to do with politics. That the announcement came on the very day Mitt Romney is set to formally accept the GOP nomination for president is just coincidence. To Shell Oil, the announcement could not come soon enough. Shell can now begin prep work for the drilling operation. That includes installing in the sea systems to assist the future blowout preventer, like a 20-foot by 40-foot mud-lined cellar. The company can also start top drilling, boring down to hollow pipes, but not all the way to oil-rich depths. Peter Slaby is vice president at Shell Alaska.
This permit would allow us to get to the 1,300, 1,400-foot level where we'll set the 20-inch casing and then get ready to run the BOPs. So, you know, it depends on where we find hydrocarbons in any given well, but, you know, somewhere about 4,000 feet or so above a hydrocarbon level.
To get down to those further reaches, Shell still needs to prove its containment capacity is up to Coast Guard standard. The Arctic Challenger, the refurbished decades-old vessel with the containment systems, has not been approved yet. Secretary Salazar says Shell cannot drill for oil without the Arctic Challenger on site. Right now, it's in Washington State, and once approved, it will take 2 weeks to make the voyage to the drilling sites in the Chukchi Sea.
Shell, frankly, has missed their own deadlines relative to when they thought that it was going to be ready. And now they're telling us that it's probably 4 or 5 days away before certification.
And that has environmental groups up in arms. Michael Levine, an attorney with Oceana and Juno, says there is no reason for the government to okay the initial prep work if Shell cannot show it's ready to drill in the remote reaches of the Arctic. And by granting this approval, he says, it shows the government is willing to bend over backward for the company and speed things along.
No matter how many vessels Shell has mobilized or how much money the company has spent, it still must be held accountable for protecting the Arctic Ocean.
Levine says it's reasonable to think this is as far along as Shell will get this summer. Peter Slaby admits the operation is running against the clock. Drilling thousands of feet into the seabed is not a quick process.
We figure a well drilled through the points of interest will take anywhere from about 20 to 24 days.
That starts when Shell begins its top hole drilling as soon as next week. And with that time frame, Shell may need an extension to drill past the September 24th deadline. That's all, of course, if Shell still wants to drill the exploratory wells it's been aiming for all year. But Slaby seems to still have a positive outlook for what can be put in place now for future Arctic work.
All this work on top holes is clearly going to help us as well put real wind in our sails for 2013 as well.
And to many, 2013 may look like a more reasonable start date. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Construction is nearing completion on the state's largest wind farm, Golden Valley Electric Association's $93 million Eva Creek project. A ribbon cutting was held yesterday at a hilltop site near Healy. KUAC's Dan Bross attended and has this story.
You can't miss the wind turbines as you drive along the Parks Highway near Healy, even though they're miles off the road. Eva Creek project manager Greg Wyman describes the 12 turbines that have added a new feature to the viewshed.
Each individual turbine stands 262 feet tall to the center of the hub. The blade diameter is 303 feet, so each one of the three blades is about 149 feet long. When the blade is in strictly a vertical position, the tip of the blade is going to be 415 feet above the ground surface.
The big towers are 13 miles up a reconstructed old mining road, well above treeline, where brisk winds strafe a barren, rounded ridge. The turbine location is also conveniently next to the northern intertie transmission line, allowing easy transfer of the wind energy onto the grid. Wyman says at peak capacity, the wind farm will be able to crank out some serious electricity for customers on par with the utility's nearby coal-fired plant.
25 megawatts, maybe 9,000 homes. It's basically the same size as our Healy 1 coal plant. That's a 25-megawatt plant, too.
Wyman cautions that the vagaries of wind require fossil fuel backup. Oil-fired units in Fairbanks, which can be idled back easily, will be adjusted to accept the wind energy. The Eva Creek project is a step toward GVEA's goal of getting 20% of peak power from renewables by 2014. A transition board member Aaron Gunderson welcomes, citing the obvious advantage of non-fossil fuel burning infrastructure.
After it's built, the cost has been spent. Aside from regular maintenance and repairs, which will happen, the fuel cost is zero. And that's the highest part of the cost of electricity.
Gunderson says low-interest financing and state support make the investment in wind a good deal. But co-op president and CEO Corey Borgeson says customers should not expect big rate savings.
It's contingent upon a number of different things. The cost of oil, the ability to get other alternative forms of energy from the Anchorage area using gas as generation also affects the savings that this project will generate. But in most all methods that we've looked at this project, we see that there will be some savings to members.
Borgeson says Eva Creek's average production of 9 megawatts represents a small portion of the utility's peak 200-megawatt output. The wind farm is coming online as Golden Valley pursues a controversial effort to put a second coal-fired plant at Healy into service, a push Borgeson says spawned the Eva Creek project.
Part of the process of our permitting of the Healy Clean Coal Plant was a requirement that we study wind in this area. This, I see, as a beginning for Golden Valley's members to use renewable energy.
Borgeson says compensating when conditions are calm currently constrains how far Golden Valley can go with wind, but adds new energy storage technology could change that in the future. The Eva Creek project has irritated some locals at Ferry, a tiny community off the Parks Highway that's base of operations for construction. A small group staged a protest Wednesday, including Terry Henman, who says wind power isn't the issue.
What I am against is the location they picked and the money they're spending just to build the road to put them there.
Henman is suspect that the road and wind turbines will stand up to the area's extreme conditions. He also accuses Golden Valley and its contractors of being unresponsive to complaints about damage to local roads and blocked access to their private property. Another protester, Kathy Lake, says worker traffic delays her kids from getting to school. Lake also has environmental concerns with the wind project.
The location of the towers is displacing an area where we normally have caribou, where thousands of cranes come over every fall. I can keep going on.
Golden Valley worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to design the Eva Creek project to minimize bird deaths. GVEA's Borgeson acknowledges the project has been an imposition on Ferry, but says every effort's been made to communicate with the community. A side benefit of Eva Creek is a power drop at Ferry, which currently does not have access to GVEA electricity. The Eva Creek wind turbines are expected to come online in October. In Ferry, I'm Dan Bross.
One of the most renowned Yupik skin sewers has died. Lucy Beaver passed away in Anchorage on August 23rd. No one's exactly sure how old she was, but those who knew her agree she was at least 100. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Lucy Beaver could have been as old as 113 years, according to her own accounts to family members. She was an icon within the Yupik community. Her portrait, taken by Alaskan photographer Myron Rosenberg, is known worldwide. The picture shows her holding her grandson, who is sleeping in her lap. They are both donning fur parkas. Beaver was known for her expert skin sewing and made mukluks, or Yupik winter boots, for hundreds, some say even thousands, of people over the years. She also made many parkas with intricate fur designs and beadwork. In a translated interview with KYUK in 1985, Beaver said she learned to sew on skins when she was a little girl by drawing designs in the mud with her story knife. She said no one taught her how to sew. She just watched others doing it. But she didn't always like it.
After I married, my husband used to have me sew. He'd let me sew on my own. I was a young girl then, and I enjoyed being outside. I wouldn't want to sew. And I'd cry because I hated to sew.
Beaver learned to like sewing parkas and boots the most because she said they were useful in keeping the body warm. Traditionally, men's parkas were made with fur from the backs of muskrats, and women's were made from the animal's belly fur. Here, she describes the significance of the wolverine tassels that hang from the front and back of a man's decorated parka.
They say the tassel on the lower right side is part of the one in the back. These represent pretend arrows. The arrow is shot, it goes into a person and goes through on the other side. Those people in the past used to say that this is why that decoration of a tassel was put on, this pretend arrow that was shot into a man.
Beaver said her designs turned out better than her mother's because she had more modern materials to work with. She adapted designs from the Yukon and upriver areas outside of her traditional family or village design. There was no real rhyme or reason. She said she used whatever design she liked. Beaver was born in a fall camp on the lower Kuskokwim River and was raised in Nunapachok, where she and her late husband George Beaver raised their children. Later, they relocated to Bethel. And there, she was deeply devoted to the Moravian Church. Her home was built using one half of the original Bethel Moravian Church. She was often heard singing hymns in Yupik as she sewed. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, vandals strike the reindeer pens at UAF.
They're very gentle, docile animals, and just the idea that somebody wants to go in and do them harm, that was the disturbing part.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects, on the web at grantstation.com. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Vandals broke into the reindeer pens and destroyed the greenhouses on the southwestern corner of campus at the University of Alaska Fairbanks late Wednesday night. The incident may have contributed to the death of a reindeer calf. Another calf was injured, and an entire growing season's worth of data is lost for one researcher. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
In recent years, the reindeer research program has installed security cameras to monitor the safety of the 90 animals that are part of the program. Director Greg Finstad says it was just a coincidence that those cameras weren't working when someone broke into a pen housing a dozen reindeer calves. They pulled up a steel post and threw it at the animals.
We had one calf injured, and we possibly lost another calf. We had a calf died just recently, and we think was related to stress related to that vandalism event.
This isn't the first incidence of vandalism to the reindeer pens. 10 years ago, someone cut through the fence in an attempt to free the herd.
When people cut the fence to let the animals out, it's a crime, but you know, they think they're doing it for the benefit of the animal. This was totally different. This was malicious. The intent was to injure or kill a reindeer calf. They're very gentle, docile animals, and just the idea that somebody wants to go in and do them harm, that was the disturbing part.
Horticulture professor Miriam Carlson is also reeling from the event. The offending party shredded the plastic that covers a series of greenhouses where she does her research. They also pulled up tomato and sunflower plants critical to her work.
We used those for some studies where we are looking at different light intensities and light qualities. They were now flowering, and this is basically the critical time that I'm really interested in seeing how long it took for them to flower and how many leaves they produced before the flower. So they were just snapped off and pulled out, so I lost that data as well.
Carlson estimates the greenhouses are worth about $2,000, but she can't put a value on the data she's lost. Greg Finstead says the loss of data is extremely serious in research, but none of the reindeer affected were part of any current studies. The University Police Department has increased their patrols in the area. Police Chief Sean McGee says he's looking into limiting what he calls unfettered access at the farm. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A remote volcano in the western Aleutians has started rumbling. An earthquake swarm at Little Sitkin started around 7 p.m. on Wednesday and picked up this morning, prompting the Alaska Volcano Observatory to put the volcano on watch. So far, no eruptive activity has been detected. Rick Wessels is a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he says the earthquakes have been striking just a few miles below the volcano. He says that while the quakes have been hitting at regular intervals, they haven't been very powerful.
If you're standing on the island, you probably wouldn't have felt any of these, but from a volcano perspective, you know, there's a lot of activity there at depth that was going on that wasn't going on 24 hours ago.
The normally quiet volcano is located in an unpopulated stretch of the Aleutian chain. The nearest community is Adak, at a distance of 200 miles. But Little Sitkin is just 20 miles away from Amchitka, a former nuclear test site. Wessel says the proximity of these two places isn't a cause for concern. Weapons tests in the 1960s and 70s did not trigger seismic activity. He says if Little Sitkin did erupt, it wouldn't look like a science fiction movie.
Yeah, I don't expect to see Godzilla or anything coming out of this one.
Wessels adds that the bigger worry is flight traffic, and the volcano's aviation color code has been raised to yellow. Cargo and passenger planes regularly travel near Little Sitkin, and an ash cloud from an eruption could affect flights. The volcano is expected to remain on 24-hour watch through the weekend.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Officials in Sitka are looking to offload two pieces of vacant city property, and they're hoping the land can be used to develop affordable housing. The city will seek proposals for land along Halibut Point Road that it calls the Old City Shops property. Voters in 2006 approved the land for affordable housing, but there's been little movement on the plan so far. They're also looking at another parcel called the Benchlands. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
It can be difficult to find an affordable place to live in Sitka. How difficult? Well, the federal government has a definition for affordable housing. It says members of a household should not pay more than 30% of their annual income toward housing. But in Sitka, many do.
This is what really is scary to me.
That is John Holst, and he gave the assembly some numbers. In 1990, 22 years ago, about a quarter of the people who rented places to live in Sitka paid more than the federal government said they should.
By the year 2000, it had gone up to 38%. And in the year 2010, it was 60%.
So So at the start of this decade, a majority of renters in Sitka paid more than the 30% of their annual income just to put a roof over their heads. What's more, Sitka has a rental vacancy rate of 1.2%.
Statistically, 5% is supposed to be a healthy vacancy rate, which allows people to move. At anything close to 1%, people are pretty much locked into where they're living.
Holst is part of an ad hoc committee looking at what the city should do with the Benchlands. That is a collection of land north of town that the city purchased back in 2007. Sitka paid about $3 million for the property and dropped another $10 million to develop it. The hope was to put the land up for sale and make some money in the process, but lately, the city has simply been hoping to break even. In December, the city tried to auction off some lots in the area, but had no takers. Holst's committee came up with 7 options for the assembly. They range from the status quo, which is continuing to sell lots in Jacob Circle, to selling all the Benchlands at auction with a minimum bid of $3 million.
Pick a priority that you're comfortable with, and then go down the list one more. Go to the next one that makes you just a little bit uncomfortable, because I think we need to be doing something that is going to change the status quo.
There are pros and cons to each option, of course, in how much control the city has, in how much money it gets back, and in whether the sale creates any affordable housing.
There is no one single simple solution to the affordability thing. I'm convinced of that. I was involved with a lot of that with CETA as well as on the assembly. It was a big push when I was on the assembly to do that. I mean, we hired somebody to do it, and then we didn't listen to them. But the more you decide on what the land development's going to be, the more control you take, the less likely you are going to have that you're going to have somebody that's going to want to come in and do it.
Some assembly members favored option 7, which was to sell the entire Benchlands. The idea of getting the city out of the land development business was appealing, they said. In the end, though, no decision was made, but Holst felt some urgency and quoted something he heard from Assemblymember Bill Payden.
The development on the Benchlands was imminent in 1962.
Holst urged the assembly to do something before the October 2nd municipal election, fearing that a new assembly will put the conversation back at square one.
This is probably as capable or more capable a group of 7 people we've had to deal with this issue in a long time.
Well, thank
and
you
I
for
think
that.
You ought
we
to
will
just
then.
Dig into it.
All righty.
If you don't get it done by the election, so be it.
I'll look at our meeting schedule.
The assembly ended up scheduling another meeting to discuss the matter. It takes place September 20th at 5 p.m. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
International eyes are turning to the Arctic as a rich source of energy, and some Alaska Native corporations are looking ahead to securing a strong position in future infrastructure development and ownership. At the Arctic Imperative Summit in Girdwood last weekend, state agency officials mixed with Native corporation representatives for a look at possible partnerships. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
The Arctic is luring global investment, and the state of Alaska is working to attract as much of that investment as possible while recognizing that Alaska Native corporations play a key role. Hugh Short chairs the board of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or AIDA. Short told those gathered at the Arctic Imperative Summit that investors and Alaska Native corporations are a good match.
I see a lot of CEOs, chairmen of the board of Alaska Native corporations in this room. They own 44 million acres in this state. 12% of the land mass is owned by Alaska Native corporations. And so if you're looking for an investment partner, they're right there. You're probably sitting next to one who is a shareholder of an Alaska Native corporation who has resources, oil and gas, hydrocarbons, coal, gold, platinum, you name it, it's in this room.
Short himself is a Chelista shareholder. He says changes in AIDA's board structure has made the agency easier to approach for development financing, and AIDA is open for business.
AIDA is an agency today that can own all or part of a development or infrastructure project. So the state of Alaska can be your partner in equity, in debt, in your infrastructure project. I think this is really important for the Alaska Native corporations in the room because many of the challenges is infrastructure, whether it's a port to get your resources out, whether it is a transmission line to be able to electrify a project. All those are challenges, and what we've been able to do is get the authority to actually invest into those projects.
Schwartz says ADA is the state vehicle to work with to get a project off the ground. Arctic Slope Region Incorporated is taking up ADA on its offer. Crawford Putkatuk chairs ASRC's board.
ASRC has recently entered into a partnering agreement with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to do a pre-feasibility or concept engineering analysis on a potential deep water port location within our Arctic region. The study will focus on a multi-use port for servicing multiple industries, including our own coal resources. As part of the analysis, we are evaluating the suitability of both offshore and onshore related infrastructure. This is an important step by ASRC and demonstrates our desire to have some control and financial return on future Arctic development.
Speaking on Saturday at a session on sustainable development in the Arctic, Putkatuk said Alaska Natives should recognize opportunities in development.
For the Inupiat, the Arctic is our identity. It provides for our sustenance and our economic sustainability. If the future of the Arctic means continued development, then that is our destiny as well.
Putkatuk says ASRC's leadership recognizes working for the shareholders with a balance of sustainability, profitability, and the protection of subsistence.
We are the Arctic experts. We are not looking for a handout, but we are looking for acknowledgement that our region is important and that we are included at every level. Maximum participation and benefit by our people, because we are taking the most risk.
Putkatuk says ASRC is ready to participate in development as long as it is done on terms compatible with Alaska Native values and heritage. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Ferry, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ellen Lockyer in Girdwood. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.